The handsome guy in the lower left.
What's your name?
Is that Mr. Fourier?
Yeah.
Okay. Are y'all going to
play? Honestly.
Yes.
So are we doing thermodynamics today?
Doing what?
Are we doing thermodynamics today?
I wish.
You like thermodynamics?
You know, I got an A in thermodynamics, and I don't think I learned anything. And so it's one of these courses I've actually wanted to go back and take over again, because I really didn't get it. But I got an A. I don't know how.
That's a fairly common occurrence, I think.
Well, that was one course, though, that I really was lost in, especially when we got to the second half of the semester. In those days, we talked about things like, I remember this Carnot engine thing.
Lewis,
I aced, because that was like circuits 101. It's hilarious. All mechanical engineers, you know, stressing out.
It's like, okay, this thing is going to be
And strengths of materials that I enjoy. I actually used them when I was designing a bridge on my farm, so I felt good. I got some value. I strengths of materials. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So last time you got the big convolution lecture, and you've got the applet and a few other tools, so hopefully convolution won't be a big thing to learn. It's much easier to learn these days with all these supporting tools, I think. Today, we want to begin talking about our first transform technique. We're going to talk about Fourier series, which is an approach or an analysis technique that's used on periodic signals. So we're going to be dealing with periodic signals today, and how you model, represent, and decompose them. But this also forms the basis for all the other transforms that we'll talk about this semester. So I'm going to begin by talking about eigenfunctions, just because it's really important to me that I confuse you really badly this semester. So I thought, you know, we'll make this just that much harder just to have that much more fun. So
you've already accomplished
that. I already hit my quota on
everything's so convoluted.
Now, one of the things I like about this course, as painful as it may be for you, is to try to show you that a lot of these things we teach you in terms of basic math and statistics are really useful and really relevant to topics like this. So, how many of you have seen an eigenvalue before? And you're probably wondering why, right? Well, you know, it turns out in signal processing, they're really valuable and useful, and they give you a lot of insight, particularly when you're dealing with when you want to understand fundamental behavior of a signal or a problem or a system, and whether that's a mechanical engineering problem or an electrical engineering problem. So let's talk a little bit about representation of continuous time signals, and then we'll end up today formally introducing the Fourier series. So what is an example of a function when applied to a linear time invariant system produces an output that is a scaled version of itself? So we have a linear time invariant system. We want a function now, a signal, not a system. So we have a linear time invariant system. If I apply a sine wave to this system, what do I get as output?
A sine wave.
A sine wave. Maybe its amplitudes change, maybe its phases change a little bit, but I get a sine wave. And that's one example of a signal that when you apply it to a linear time invariant system, you basically get the same signal out. And we're going to really work that concept today extensively to get to what we call a Fourier series. So the function itself is often called an eigenfunction, and the scale factor that represents the output is called an eigenvalue. So we have your input, this could be sine of omega t, and then we get some amplitude times that sine of omega t. Now, we'll see in time why these are in fact eigenvalues and eigenfunctions, but for the moment, let's not worry too much about that. The main thing we want to do, and this is really what a Fourier series is all about, is representing a signal as a weighted sum of these eigenfunctions so that the output can be very easily computed as another weighted sum of these eigenfunctions. And this reduces the problem of finding the response of any linear time invariant system to the problem of finding these eigenvalues. And that's one of the reasons why eigenvalues are very important to you, to many disciplines in engineering. Now, what types of things influence these values, whatever these values are? And just think of these right now as mathematical constants that are associated with each one of these eigenfunctions. Well, we will soon see that the frequency response of this system is one thing that influences these values. Depending on the frequency response, the phase response, and such, we'll see some changes in these terms, but the overall output will still be a weighted sum of these eigenfunctions. In the case of Fourier series, a weighted sum of periodic signals like sine waves. So later we'll generalize this concept, but for the moment, we're just looking to represent our input signal as a weighted sum of some basis functions or eigenfunctions so that we can easily compute the output. Now, this is actually how a lot of compression systems work today as well. They take the signal and they define some functions, they represent the signal in terms of those functions, and then they simply have to transmit these coefficients to the receiver to recover the signal. This is one of the ways you do you do compression to get large amounts of compression in your signal. And sometimes, in fact, these functions are actually derived or optimized for this signal. And then these functions are transmitted along with these coefficients. If you've ever wondered what's inside of some of these JPEG files or some of these kinds of files that you deal with, you'll actually see some information about the basis functions as well as the scaling coefficients. This principle is also used in modulation theory. If you ever wonder how you actually communicate, you send signals over the airwaves using frequency shift keyed or amplitude shift keyed or any of these kinds of modulation techniques, the same kind of approach is used. Now, the Fourier series is one of many ways to decompose a signal into this kind of a representation. It's not the only way. There's lots of different ways to do that, but the Fourier series is one of the most powerful and one of the most common, and it forms the basis for a lot of what we talk about in this course. So let's look at this a little more closely. Let's talk about eigenfunctions and linear time invariant systems. So here we have an identity system. We have a system whose impulse response is delta of t. If we apply x of t to that system, what we get out is x of t convolved with delta of t, which just gives us back x of t. So in this case, you could say any function is any input or any function is an eigenfunction of the system because this system produces as output whatever the input is. So that's not that's sort of a special case, not too remarkable. But the next case is getting a little closer to what we're interested in, time delay. Time delay, as we've talked about, is the print. That's actually the way surround sound works. You're simply delaying the various components of the signal so that they will align at some point in space, and to give you the sense then that these sounds are actually moving around in a 2 or 3D sound field. And then when you add to that the filtering capability, then you can also introduce the sound effects processing where you make it sound like a concert hall or some such thing. Any periodic function applied to this system will produce a time-delayed version of itself. So any periodic function is an eigenfunction of this system. And that's a good thing because we're going to want to deal with periodic functions with Fourier series. A more sort of more sophisticated example, we have here a system which is time reversal. And for this system, we can show, I won't go through the details, but we can show that cosine is an eigenfunction. Sines and cosines generally are an eigenfunction for linear time invariant systems, and that's why something like a Fourier series is done in terms of sines and cosines. Now, to further complicate things, we're actually going to talk today about complex Fourier series first, which uses a complex exponential instead of sines and cosines. But we'll, by the end of today, relate all those things together. So let's now talk about the types of eigenfunctions that we'll use with our linear time invariant systems. Complex exponentials are always eigenfunctions for a linear time invariant system, and extremely useful because the output is a scaled version of the input. So if our input is e to the st, where whether s is real or complex, and we apply that to h of t, the output that we're going to get, you now know we can apply our convolution integral and take h of tau times x of t minus tau, which in this case will be e to the s of t minus tau d tau. And for this integral, we can factor out the e to the st, since that's constant with respect to the integration, and we can write this as the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of h of tau e to the minus s tau d tau times all of that times e to the st. So the first thing we observe is that the input was e to the st, the output contains e to the st, therefore e to the st is an eigenfunction. The second thing we observe is that this integral, we're going to call that h of s. This is actually something you'll come to know as a Laplace transform, but we won't go into that today. But that's actually an eigenvalue of the system. Now, on the discrete side, we're going to see throughout the semester that the analog of this e to the st is z to the power n, where z is a complex number. And we'll work through that. But for the moment, let's just look at what happens. We have a function, x of n is equal to z to the n. We apply that to a system, linear time invariant system, whose impulse response is h of n. And what we get out is y of n is equal to the convolution sum, m from minus infinity to plus infinity, of h of m z to the n minus m. Again, we can factor out a z to the n, because that's constant with respect to the summation. So we can write the sum of h of m, z to the minus m, that quantity times z to the n. So we apply z to the n as input. We get z to the n as output. That makes z to the n an eigenfunction. And this term in here is an eigenvalue, and that's essentially what we'll come to know as the z transform of this system. So the interesting thing about this point of view is that we can view these transforms, Laplace transforms, Z transforms, as simply what you get when you apply these eigenfunctions to the system. Now again, I'm not going to, this, you can forget this probably as you walk out the door or sooner, and that won't worry me, but someday if you go into more advanced studies, you can say, oh yeah, I saw this here. So let's talk now about complex Fourier series. This I will hold you responsible for. So what types of signals can be represented as sums of complex exponentials? I don't remember. Have you seen Fourier series in your math classes? I don't think they do anymore. It used to be we would teach that in engineering, applied math or something. Well, for continuous time systems, if we had e to the st, if we let s be equal to j omega, that actually gives us what we call a Fourier transform. And that means we have signals of the form e to the j omega t. E to the j omega t, if you recall, can be written as cosine omega t plus j sine omega t. So it's sort of, it's a complex form of a sinusoid. On the discrete side, we have z is equal to e to the j omega, and that's what we call a z transform. And this gives us signals of the form e to the j omega n. These representations form the basis of the Fourier series and the Fourier transform, both of which we're going to study now. We'll start with the Fourier series, and then we'll move to the Fourier transform after that. So consider a periodic signal. And you'll recall that for a periodic signal, we define capital T as the smallest such t for which this signal repeats itself. We call that the fundamental period. And the frequency associated with the fundamental period, we call this the fundamental frequency. In radians, it's 2 pi over capital T. In hertz, it's just 1 over T. Now, that's an important concept. It's sort of obvious, but we have this periodic signal. If you looked at this signal in a spectrum analyzer, what do you think you would see?
See a line of...
So that, have you had a chance to look at signals in the lab with spectrum analyzers or something like that?
We've done Fourier analysis on like computer systems.
So, you know, if this signal is...
We didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah, we didn't know what we were doing, but we've done it.
Okay, well...
We had no idea what it meant.
That sounds a lot like thermal we were discussing.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, this signal, think of this, if this were a sine wave at this, at a frequency omega zero or f zero, what do you think it looks like in the frequency domain?
Is it just a really big spike at that one?
At that frequency, excellent.
1 over t?
Right. If it's a more complicated signal that's represented as a sum of multiples of this frequency, what we're going to show is that all periodic signals are essentially decomposable into energy that resides at their fundamental frequency and then multiples of that fundamental frequency. And that's a very interesting result. That's one of the reasons we can actually use them to modulate signals into higher portions of the frequency spectrum. So let's consider representing a signal as a sum of complex exponentials. We're going to write x of t is equal to the sum from k is equal to minus infinity to plus infinity of c sub k e to the j k omega 0 t. Okay. Now, what does that mean?
It's kind of cool, actually.
Well, these e to the j k omega 0 t's, they're kind of scary. But remember, what was our sort of graphical depiction of that function?
It's a point on the unit circle.
You can think of that as a vector of length 1 that's rotating with the frequency omega 0. So, if you think about this vector with length 1 and it's rotating at a frequency of omega 0, what happens if you look at the projection of this vector along the x-axis?
You get the real coordinate or real value?
You'll get the real value.
What's the cosine?
And what will that real value be?
It's the cosine of the angle.
It's going to be cosine. Right, very good. And then what happens if you look at the projection along the vertical axis? Remember, this is rotating, so the magnitude is going to go up and down, up and down, up and down, kind of a thing. That's going to be
sine.
So this e, recalling that e to the j omega 0 t is just cosine omega 0 t plus j sine omega 0 t.
On that vector that is revolving or rotating, Hey, when you say it rotates with a frequency of omega 0, does that mean that it goes through 2 pi, like a 2 pi revolution?
Right.
Every, okay.
Right. So in terms of hertz, it's, you know, 1 hertz is the, would mean it takes essentially 1 second to repeat itself. So it's one second it makes this cycle.
If omega 0 is less or more than
right. So we're going to represent the signal this way. We know we can also represent omega 0 as 2 pi over capital T. And this representation, because these functions are periodic with period T, we can also write that this is equal to x of t plus capital T. So this representation is periodic with period capital T, and that's easy to see here because every time this T hits capital T, you have essentially a value of a multiple 2 pi. The C sub k are what we call the complex Fourier series coefficients, these things. And k equals 0 corresponds to the DC value, meaning when k is equal to 0, we have a constant term. That's essentially going to represent the DC component of the signal. If you take this signal and you hook it to a DC voltmeter, what you will see eventually is the C sub 0 value. And then k is equal to 1 is what we call the first harmonic. That's e to the j omega 0 t. So that's going to have energy in the spectrum at a frequency of omega 0 or a frequency of f 0. K is equal to 2 will be e to the 2 omega 0 t. That's going to have energy at twice the fundamental frequency. So periodic signals only have energy at DC and then multiples of the fundamental frequency.
So K equals 1 would be the fundamental frequency.
Right. And then K equals 2 and so forth. Now remember that. We're going to come back to that repeatedly throughout the semester, that periodic signals always have energy only at multiples of the fundamental frequency. This is why, for example, you can take two periodic signals and if they have different fundamental frequencies, you can actually add them together and then split them apart again, because they don't overlap in the spectrum. They can sort of interlace. And we make use of that kind of a concept when we do things like analog communications.
So if you had a sum of sinusoids as your signal instead of just a single sinusoid, there would be energy at multiples of both fundamental frequencies?
Very good. So if you have two signals with different fundamental frequencies, you would have energy at all the different, at multiples of the one fundamental frequency and multiples of the other fundamental frequency.
And then they would overlap at certain points.
They could potentially overlap. That's right. And remember, the resulting signal, when you have the sum of two periodic signals, the result is not necessarily periodic. It depends on the relationship between the two frequencies. But for that's a detail we won't really dwell on this semester. So we're going to deal mostly with situations where the sum of periodic signals is itself a periodic signal. Now, what gets a little bit confusing with the Fourier series is that there's these alternate representations. For communication systems, we generally prefer the complex form of the Fourier series. But in other areas of science, you will see the trigonometric Fourier series used. These two are related very simply by the fact that if you simply expand this term in terms of cosine plus j sine, you can write an expression for the trigonometric Fourier series. And now we talk about the coefficients A0, AKs, and BKs. Also, you can recall that the sum of a cosine and a sine can also be represented as a cosine plus a phase angle. So this is often what's called the cosine with phase version of the Fourier series. We'll make use of each of these at various points throughout the semester, but you can go back and forth between them, and later we'll actually derive some of the relationships for that.
What is the A0 on the first two? Is that what you would consider the DC value? Or?
Yeah, that's still the DC value, because you'll notice that the sums here go from K is equal to 1. So that's still going to be DC value. That's good observation. Now, the question is, okay, so here's the representation. What are the unknowns? Well, A0s, AKs, and BKs, or the C sub Ks. How are we going to go about finding how we represent the signal X in terms of those coefficients? Well, there are several ways to arrive at the equations for estimating the coefficients. We'll, of course, choose the most complicated one. And most are based on concepts of orthogonal functions and vector space projections. Which
just makes you sound smarter when you say it.
Well, as you see, you're taking my joke away there. So somewhere here we have Hilbert spaces. So I'm going to introduce Hilbert space mainly so that you're at a party someday. There's a lot of different engineering disciplines out there. Throw around Hilbert space and you'll get their attention.
Name dropping that Hilbert space.
So one of the ways we can think about computing these coefficients, again, I won't hold you to this, but I just want you to get a little bit of appreciation for how we use some of the math that you've learned. The concept of a vector projection is actually one way you can derive the equations for this, for the Fourier series. And one approach is to use essentially a vector, which in a three-dimensional space we can write as the sum of three weights times three unit vectors, x hat, y hat, and z hat are unit vectors. How do we find the components? If we have a vector and we want to represent it in terms of these three axes, how do we find those components? Well, you use a dot product. That's one of the reasons why you learn a dot product. It's a way to project this vector onto these three axes. In most signal representations, we use axes which are perpendicular. But actually, in some signal processing algorithms, we don't even require these axes to be perpendicular. But for this class, of course, we will. This projection works nicely because these axes are perpendicular, so the dot products between them are zero, and therefore it becomes a nice compact representation. So we can apply the same concept to signals using, like I said, the notion of a Hilbert space in which each axis represents an eigenfunction. So the way to think about this is x of t is going to be our signal. These e to the j k omega 0 t's, these are essentially the axes. Each one of these axes corresponds to a different one of these exponentials. And these c sub k's are essentially these, what they represent the weights of this vector. So this is a way to think about the signal in what's called a signal space. And that's the way we visualize this type of thing so that we can do this mathematically.
So could you explain exactly what those axes are? Like?
Well, in the case of a Fourier series, these axes are the eigenfunctions. So they would correspond to the multiples of k. Now, again, this is sort of it's a theoretical detail, but I just want you to appreciate that one of the ways compression systems work is they actually try to find the best axes to most compactly represent the signal. And that's all can be done very nicely through these kinds of dot product operations and things. Another thing that we'll see later in the semester is that once you have the signal in this kind of representation, you can rotate it into a lot of different representations. And that's something that we make use of in a lot of different kinds of signal processing systems.
Is there an infinite number of coefficients, but are there an infinite number of axes? Or how does that
That's why it's a Hilbert space. See, I told you, when someone's... Yeah, it's a Hilbert space because there's an infinite number of these axes. But any one of these axes is essentially just a projection. The coefficient for that axis is just a projection of the signal onto that axis through a dot product.
Okay, so I guess in this picture, what exactly is our vector?
Your vector is your signal.
Okay, so, all right, and then...
What are the axes? It's not necessarily moving as a function of time. The axes are eigenfunctions. This is your signal, and it's all static, if you will.
Which eigenfunctions exactly? Is it the eigenfunction of the system?
If it's a Fourier series, it's these. These e to the j.
Okay, we just picked that one because we're trying to do a Fourier series.
Right. If we were doing something like a JPEG compression, we might actually derive these axes. This might be represent one direction through the image. This might represent another direction through the image.
So, however many k's we want to find, say 8 harmonics, we'd have 8 dimensions.
Right. So the way compression systems work is they represent the signal this way, then they rotate this space into another space where the axes are ordered by the most significant, and then they essentially lop off the higher order terms, which hopefully are not that important to the overall quality of the picture.
You don't do that by hand, do you?
No, it's done automatically.
That sounds really.
But that's
scary.
Why, if you ever watch the way JPEG images refresh, the progressives or interlaced, whatever they call those, that's essentially what it's doing. It transmits the first pass of coefficients, which gives you the base image, and then it adds the higher order details. Okay. So anyway, and not like I said, I'm not going to ask you about the Hilbert spaces on the exam. But I am going to show you some calculations, and you might wonder, well, where did those come from? Well, they actually come from knowledge of the things I discussed on the previous slide. So we can make use of the principle of orthogonality in the Hilbert space, which just means that if we multiply this term by another axis, or another complex exponential, the integral over a full period of e to the j k omega 0 t times another e to the j n omega 0 t, this can be shown fairly easily to be equal to 1 when k and n are the same, and equal to 0 otherwise. And that's a consequence of this orthogonality concept and the fact that this is essentially an inner product. So we can apply this to our Fourier series. We can take our complex Fourier series. We can essentially take x of t, multiply it by e to the minus j n omega 0 t. We can then substitute for x of t our Fourier series representation here. And we can then interchange the order of summation and integration, because the integral of a sum is just the sum of the integrals. And we can pull this constant c sub k outside of the integral, because the integral is with respect to dt. So we can write 1 over t times the sum from k is equal to minus infinity to plus infinity of c sub k times this integral of e to the j k minus n omega 0 t dt. And this integral, using our principle of orthogonality here, is simply equal to c sub n when k is equal to n.
So when you look at the spectrum analysis of a signal, then at each particular frequency or k, the height of the spike is Cn?
Yes, and we'll see that shortly. But for the moment now, I've just shown you how to go about calculating the coefficients. We just take x of t, multiply it by e to the minus jk omega 0 t, and integrate over a full period. So this equation is what we call the analysis. This gives you the ability, given a signal, to compute the Fourier series coefficients. This equation is what we call the synthesis. It gives you the ability to take the coefficients and resynthesize the signal. Together, these can form the basis of what we might call a compression system. You analyze the signal, transmit these coefficients to the receiver, and then at the receiver, you construct the new signal based on these coefficients. And hopefully, it requires less bandwidth or less data per second to transmit these coefficients than to transmit the original signal. The other nice thing about this is, as we were talking about with this, something like JPEG images, you can send the important stuff first, and then send the less important stuff later, and that's how you can achieve the effect of updating a progressively scanned image or that kind of thing.
But, I mean, you lose, like, harmonic 75 or something like that, right?
This is an as, of course, in the world of math, we can go out to infinity, and this is an exact representation, and we'll see, most of the time, we'll see some reasons why it isn't all the time. But when you're talking about compression, yeah, you're going to limit this k to maybe as low as, in some cases, 8 to 10.
So do our eyes work like that in any way?
Sort of. Your eyes, that'd probably take us too far. And I'm not current on that, but your eyes are, and CCD cameras are very similar principle, that you have a bunch of receptors of varying, tuned to varying frequencies and things. So the human ear certainly works sort of along this way, manner, in that what happens is the audio signal, when it hits your ear, is essentially laid out across the inner ear. In your inner ear, you have something called the cochlea, which is a bunch of hair cells. Each one of those hair cells is tuned to a different frequency. The signal is essentially laid out in frequency in your ear, and if it's a sine wave at 1 kHz, it excites this frequency and that force. So your ear is essentially doing a Fourier analysis, and then what goes into your brain, your nervous system, are all these hair cell electrical signals, and then you somehow put all that together and recognize it as a particular sound. And I think the principle of the eye is similar, but I think in the case of the eye, there's a conversion to space from space to frequency. So let's look at an example of this using a periodic pulse train. Here we have a signal x of t. It's periodic, and we can go ahead and compute the Fourier series coefficients. So we're going to take x of t times e to the minus j k omega 0 t, integrate over a full period, and that's going to give us the c sub k's. So we have this integral, which we can write as the integral from minus t1 to plus t1, because x of t is 0 elsewhere. X of t over this interval is constant, so we simply have the integral of e to the minus j k omega 0 t, which we can write as e to the minus j k omega 0 t over minus j k omega 0. And we can then apply the limits of integration here, and we have essentially the difference of two terms. And if you do work through the simplifications of this, leave the j here, pull the constants out, we can write it in this form. Now this function is interesting, and we're going to see this a lot this semester. We have e to the jx minus e to the minus jx over 2j. What does that look like?
The hyperbolic cosine.
Except we have j's here. So it's a sine. So this is sine of the argument, k omega 0 t1. But we also have this constant term, k omega 0 t. Well, omega 0 is 2 pi over t times t, and the t's essentially cancel, so we have this sine k omega 0 over t1 divided by k times pi. So that's a relatively simple expression for this pulse. If we plot this, now again, pay a little bit of attention here, because this is going to come back and haunt you throughout the semester. If we plot this function as a function of k omega 0, or if we plot it as a function of k, we get a plot which looks something like this. We can also think of this as frequency, though, because this each one of these k's corresponds to a frequency of k omega 0, or kf 0. And therefore, we can think of this as a plot of frequency and amplitude. And this shows us very clearly that periodic signals have energy at multiples of the fundamental frequency. And the amplitude of that energy, if you will, or the amplitude of the spectrum, is given by that equation. And this goes out to infinity, though it is decreasing in amplitude. Now, that's kind of interesting. If you've ever transmitted this kind of a signal over a real cable, like a piece of coax or something, what do you typically see at the other end?
A really wavy looking thing.
A smooth square wave?
What?
A smooth square wave.
What usually happens to these edges? They get rounded, right? And that's because you're essentially lopping off the higher frequency components of the square wave. And by doing that, you essentially round off the square wave. That's what you see in the real world, because in the real world, you don't have infinite frequency bandwidth. The cable only has a fixed amount of bandwidth. So this becomes the frequency response of this signal, and it gives us a lot of insight into how time domain signals produce energy in the frequency domain, particularly the fact that these edges, these sharp edges, generate high frequencies. Now, how can a series composed of continuous functions, sines and cosines, approximate a discontinuous function such as a square wave? Conditions for which the error in this approximation will tend to zero. Now, these are three conditions which are required of the signal, which will allow us to get an exact representation using the Fourier series. One of them is that x of t must be what's called absolutely integrable, which means the integral of the absolute value of x of t over a period has to be less than infinity. That's true for most signals, but here's an example of a periodic signal for which that isn't true. X of t must have a finite time interval. In a finite time interval, x of t must have a finite number of maxima and minima. This is a function, you will never see this as an electrical engineer, but mathematicians think up this stuff all the time. This is a really interesting function, because as t goes to zero, what happens is it cycles faster and faster. So this is actually a function which violates that requirement, but we won't really use this in this class. And then for a finite time interval, x of t must have a finite number of discontinuities. Here's an example of a signal which doesn't quite meet that, but most signals do. These are known as the Dirichlet conditions, and they'll be satisfied for most signals we encounter in the real world, which means that we will get convergence of the Fourier series. So let's look at an example of that. The Fourier series does result in something called the Gibbs phenomena. So we will get convergence if those conditions on the previous slide are met. However, the manner in which we get convergence can be kind of interesting. So here we have a plot of a square wave. The Fourier series of a square wave here is plotted as a function of n, the number of terms in the finite series. So here we have n is equal to 1, where we use only one sine wave to model the pulse. Here we have n equals 2, or n equals 3 rather, n equals 7, n equals 19, n equals 79. And what you see is that we are getting a good level of convergence of the Fourier series to the signal, but we're having this oscillation at the corners, at these edges. And this was first observed in 1898. It's known as the Gibbs phenomenon, fairly common when you're doing Fourier series of square waves. The squared error does actually converge to zero, but you don't get convergence uniformly. Most of your error is occurring at the edges of the signal.
Does the amplitude of that error decrease?
Yes. Yes, and it will converge to a pulse. It's just the manner in which it converges is a little surprising.
So I guess this is what happens when you don't take enough, when your sampling frequency is too low, it starts to, your square wave starts to wave out, I guess.
That's a similar situation. If you sample the signal at too low a frequency, you will round these edges.
Okay.
Yeah. Or you'll sometimes see oscillations. If you look at square waves in real circuits, sometimes you'll see like an oscillation transition.
So like you were saying, sometimes you can approximate a signal with as low as 8 harmonics, but your square waves will look more like jello molds. And
right, and in fact, one of the things that you will get used to seeing when you look at real signals transmitted over real channels is the actual signal that's transmitted is often a very noisy version of the original signal. But as long as you're able to recover the frequency or things of the phase or things like that, you can reconstruct the signal perfectly at the other end. So, what did we do today? We introduced the concept of eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. Why did we introduce that? Well, aside from wanting to make this more difficult than it needs to be, eigenfunctions form the basis for what we call a Fourier series. The function, that e to the j omega t term, if you ever wonder where that comes from, that comes from this concept of an eigenfunction. We developed the concept of a Fourier series. What types of signals do we apply Fourier series to?
Periodic
signals. Now later in the semester we'll talk about the Fourier transform, which is something we apply to signals that are not periodic. And we'll talk about Laplace transform as well. But thus far we've talked about a transform that we can use for periodic signals called a Fourier series. When we apply a periodic signal to a linear time invariant system, what do we get at the output? Get what?
Did you say that the linear system?
When we have a linear time invariant system and we apply a Fourier series, we apply a periodic signal, what do we know about the output?
It's going to be a periodic signal.
It will also be a periodic signal. Its amplitude structure and its phase structure may change, but it will still be a periodic signal. Therefore, if we decompose an input signal into a weighted sum of periodic signals, we can easily compute the output as a sum of those same periodic signals, and that's all a Fourier series is. We discussed three representations of the Fourier series. We talked mostly about the complex Fourier series, but there's also the trigonometric Fourier series and the phase form of the Fourier series. But they're all three interchangeable, so we'll work mostly with the complex Fourier series and the trigonometric Fourier series in this course. We derived an expression for the estimates of the coefficients. You've given a signal, it's fairly straightforward to compute the coefficients of the Fourier series using that integral equation that we introduced a few slides ago. Now later we'll show you how to do this in MATLAB and how to do this for both continuous time and discrete time signals. We derived the Fourier series for a pulse train, and we showed that the spectrum of a pulse, we actually plotted the spectrum of the pulse train. That's very important to understand that particular example and how that spectrum varies as you change the frequency of the pulse train and the width of the pulse. And you'll have some homework problems that deal with that. And then we discussed under what conditions the Fourier series can be computed. Those are known as the Dirichlet conditions. For most real-world signals, those will be met. And then we talked a little bit about the Gibbs phenomena and convergence of the Fourier series. Now, at the end of this lecture, there's an applications note on a nonlinear amplifier. So we've been talking a little bit about linearity, and this is a discussion of sort of what it means for a system to be linear from an input-output point of view, and why, if an amplitude's nonlinear, will you get an output harmonics of the input signal. And if you've ever looked at power amplifiers and you've looked at things like harmonic distortion and intermodulation, you know that what makes a good amplifier is its ability to produce very few of these harmonic products or harmonic distortion for your input signal, and that's essentially figures of merit. What figures of merit are for audio systems is how much of these nonlinear terms are produced. But if a system is linear, it will always produce a periodic signal at the same period as the input. If it's nonlinear, you'll get all sorts of cross terms and things. Okay? Yes?
Is it second order harmonic distortion that actually plays into the U in here?
Well, that's another interesting issue. So I was looking, I saw a product the other day, an iPod on the I was on the airplane, I was reading a magazine, they have one of these iPod, you talk about retro technology, an iPod amplifier with a vacuum tube. And it's actually cool looking. They have a big tube right out there, right in the middle of the amplifier. But I was thinking, gosh, that's how crazy it's gotten. Well, why do they do that? Because a lot of people still like the sound, the nonlinearities that are introduced by things like tubes.
Wouldn't that be totally